It's August 3rd, 2010. We're at the offices of the OCC in Washington, D.C. For the interview of Kim Scherer. Is that correct pronunciation? Thank you. Ms. Scherer, my name is Chris Seifert. This is Claire Moraine and Al Crago. We're all three of us with the FCIC. Statute passed last year called the Fraud Enforcement and Recovery Act 2009 established us and told us to figure out the causes of the financial crisis by the end of this year.
Good luck. Thank you.
We'll need it. We are looking at various areas, and currently, as you probably know, we are doing a case study of Countrywide and looking at what happened to Countrywide. And part of that, of course, is looking at what the OCC found about Countrywide through its examinations up until, I guess, the end of 2006 when it flipped charters and became a savings and loan holding company and a federal savings bank. So I'm going to eventually ask you about your role in Countrywide. Before we do that, I'd like you to do what we ask everybody to do, and that's just summarize your educational and work background since college, please.
Since college?
Yes.
So don't go through college.
Including college.
Okay. Graduated from Murray State University in Murray, Kentucky in 1979, with a bachelor's degree in marketing. And I became a bank examiner. Shortly there, after college, I worked for 3 months for Burroughs Corporation in the summer of 79, and I joined the OCC in September 79, and I've been with them ever since. That's pretty quick.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to go through my various positions I've held with the OCC.
Let's do that. And if the locations changed, tell me that too.
So started in September 79 in Little Rock, Arkansas. We have this commission exam test. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Became a commission examiner in May of 85 and moved in moved in 86 to Nashville, Tennessee. I was in Nashville, Tennessee, again, as a field examiner until 1989. In 89, moved to Atlanta. In Atlanta, again, getting more bigger bank experience, more regional bank, that size at that point. So I was there from 89 to 94. And then, could we just break for a second?
Sure.
We're back on. Okay. So I think I picked up in 89, I moved to Atlanta and was in Atlanta from 89 to 94, primarily examining larger banks. The last year I was in Atlanta, I worked in our district office there where I was an analyst for one of our district administrators. Then in 94, I moved to Washington, D.C., where I worked in a multinational banking division, served as an analyst here with First Union Bank and then later with Bank of America, the old Bank of America out of California. Was in that role for 3 years. To 97. From 97 to 2003, still in Washington, but different job. I was the retail credit expert for the Northeast District. So that was the geography from one of our six districts at that time, from basically Washington, D.C. up through New England. And that basically served as a support role for all of our field examiners and our management throughout that whole area and targeting problem areas of home equity lending, mortgage lending, credit card, auto, etc. In 2003, I moved back into headquarters. From 2003 to 2005, I worked in our credit market risk division, credit policy area, writing examiner and banker guidelines, policies, handbooks, etc. Was instrumental in helping write the home equity guidance during that period. And then in 2005, I moved to Calabasas, California, where I became EIC of Countrywide, late 2005. I've had one other job since they converted. They converted, I guess, in March 2007. In July 2007, I became an examiner in charge at Union Bank, which is based out of San Francisco, California, where I currently serve. It's one of our large banks in our 15 large banks in our OCC large bank program.
It's my homeowners association bank.
Oh, okay.
For my place in San Francisco. So that was from March of 07 forward?
From actually July of 07 forward.
And so you live in San Francisco?
Live in San Francisco. Yeah.
So do I, but I'm obviously out here for a year. I miss it, especially during these hot, steamy summers.
Right.
Okay, well, let's do this. Take me through, you know, generally your role as EIC on Countrywide, number of exams, who were on the examinations, general findings, and then I'll follow up. And I saw the look on your face, so give me the best you can.
Okay, let me, maybe.
Main issues.
Okay, let me kind of start with, I may have got to give a little bit of background on how we do things, and that would help.
Yes, please.
So Countrywide, just to give you a bit of chronology, it was started as a national bank in 2001. From 2001 through sometime in early 2004, and again, this is just kind of give you an understanding of how we do things. Mm-hmm. You know, we basically have two main lines of business where we have like our community banks or mid-sized banks conducted out of one line of business and operation, management operations here. And then we have our large bank division, which is what I'm a part of now, what Countrywide was then. But originally, they were in our community bank division. So from 2001 to early 2004, community banks, and really what that means is you have an assigned examiner in charge, but you take a team of examiners to go in as needed based on, you know, the risk in the bank as determined by the examiner in charge and the manager of that office. They determine, okay, we're going to go in, you know, six times this year. One time we're going to look at interest rate risk. One time we're going to look at the credit portfolio. One time we're going to look at fair lending, et cetera. You understand kind of the basic concept.
Right.
So that was in the early years. So when it comes into large banks, we then basically have on-site teams in place. The examiner in charge, plus a supporting staff of, you know, 1 to 60 people at J.P. Morgan Chase. You know what I'm saying? It just depends on the size of the bank. John Hall, you've seen the name. He actually was the first examiner in charge when it was brought into large bank supervision in 2004, and he had it for roughly a year and a few months till he retired in July of 2005. And at that time, he had not actually built up any staff yet. He was still bringing in, he was on site full time, but bringing in examiners to support him and lead exams. So I can't get into a lot of the details of all the exams that took place during that period of time. I can and I will go back in a moment to one of them that I did lead that was the home equity exam in the summer 2005, but maybe just when I started really getting familiar with the bank, I'll say.
Okay.
But then there was an interim examiner in charge, Reggie Webster, for a few months before then I came in December of 2005. So really, I was there for roughly a year and 3 months, and during that period of time, I built my staff from me to 8 of us, and I'll say that most of them came in around mid-2006. You know, it was over a period of time they came in, but we had examiners that specialized in areas of credit, in areas of compliance, information technology, capital markets, general safety and soundness, so just the broad different areas. And so we would, in addition to doing these targeted reviews where we would issue supervisory letters that you have in your documents, we would also do what we would call ongoing. We would have regular meetings with management. We would have, we would see reports that we review on a regular basis. We would, you know, prepare a quarterly report that would go up to our management. And then it will culminate in an annual communication to the board of directors there, the annual report of examination. But as I was explaining to Linda and Alyssa yesterday, these reports of examination, while they're the primary communication tool in a community bank usually, and the only annual, you know, the only communication, this is kind of like, it's a summary of everything that we've already done throughout the year there. So I'll say my involvement with them became, you know, started like in the summer of 2005 when I was the Jack Hall, John Hall, he was the lead examiner in charge of the bank, but I was brought in to head up this review, this targeted review of home equity lending. And so I was in there with a team of, I don't know, I would say, you know, eight or so examiners reviewing the various areas. I don't know if you want to go through specifics. I mean, how deep you want to get into that stuff or not.
Well, here's, let's try to do it this way. I mean, the thing that jumps out at me anyway when I look at the company's balance sheet and then more granular into the types of loans is, one, they're growing quite fast.
Mm-hmm.
Two, they're funding themselves, you know, at the bank with a lot of non-sticky deposits mm-hmm. and a lot of Federal Home Loan Bank advances. And at the holding company, and maybe we'll get into whether you guys are looking at the holding company at all. I understand the Fed does that. But, of course, the holding company is funding stuff with repos and medium-term notes and commercial paper, which, of course, were the issues that got them in the liquidity problem in August of 07. And then, in addition, in seeing this large growth, you know, it's driven by their originations. And they are doing a lot of originations in the non-traditional mortgage product, whether it's subprime and whether they reduce the FICO from 660 to 620 at some point. I forget the exact year, but I think it's around this time.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the Alt-A, whether it's the IOPO and the option payment arms. And, of course, we know that that's what drove the problems in 07. That's where a lot of the loan loss provisions came. And a good chunk of that gets sold, and they have a $1.5 trillion servicing book, I think, by the end of 06 or 07. Another slug of it goes on balance sheet at the bank, although I guess what I'm looking at is a holding, is a consolidated statement,
mm-hmm.
so I don't know how
mm-hmm.
much of it is the bank versus the holding
right.
company. And another slug of it gets securitized, and they issue their RMBS. So, you know, given what we've seen is you know, this growth
okay.
into the non-traditional mortgage
right.
product with short-term funding sources that eventually blows up on the company and causes the liquidity crisis in the B of A investment, $2 billion investment, and then ultimately the B of A acquisition. So I'm mainly interested in what you and the OCC were seeing in terms of that. I mean, I'm sure you saw the growth and you saw
right. right.
and what were the concerns. I mean, I know Al and others have read the exam reports and the other documents. I have not. So they'll probably, Al will, I'm sure, you know, chime in on, mm-hmm. on specifics after you give us the general concern. But that's what we see
okay.
is, you know, that growth until they flip charter, actually even continues. But, you know, that, of course, you guys aren't there after the end of 06. So maybe you can sort of generally address
okay.
those issues. And if there were other issues that were concerning to you guys at the time, please tell me. Because this is based on a quick financial analysis, and I'm sure there's many things I've missed.
You hit it. You summarize it very well, though. And let me just explain. Let me go back and let's talk about the bank versus the holding company. Because yeah, we did just supervise the bank, and to be honest, one of the lessons learned, I think, and of course it's already been addressed in the financial regulatory reform. But you know, the fact that the holding company, the Federal Reserve, looks at assets outside of the holding company. Outside of the bank. We look at the bank. I mean, it's kind of we did have frequent communications with the FDIC and the Federal Reserve, but we were solely focused on the bank charter and the assets in the bank, as well as, in some regard, the strength of the parent and their ability to support the bank as needed. I can't say we ignored the holding company by any means, but we relied on the Federal Reserve to examine them.
Was there, I'm sorry to interrupt,
that's okay.
Was there a net worth maintenance agreement? If the bank fell below capital requirements, did the holding company have to infuse cash to get them back
into
compliance?
That's a good question. I don't know that I technically know the answer to that. Since they own 100% of the bank, it was always assumed, you know, that's a clear assumption, mm-hmm. if not a legal requirement. I don't know legally if there was a requirement, but, I mean, that was their investment. I mean, that was their asset. So I would say, I can't say clearly yes or no. I don't
okay.
know.
Okay.
So the bank, yes, there was rapid growth in the bank. That was clear from the very beginning that they intended, like you say, they saw it as a cheaper funding source than what they could get through the holding company. They were able to go out and obtain deposits, you know, through pretty high rates. You know, I can't say they were the highest in the market, but up there.
97th percentile.
Huh?
97th percentile.
Yeah. Okay. So they're very close. They're close to the highest. They're not the highest in the market. And, you know, and management would defend that to say, you know, they actually had a, even though it was a high cost of funds, you know, they had a low infrastructure cost because these were really pretty much not maintained with a lot of personnel type branches, and you know, the cost of these was very low. So they would say that their cost of funds was actually not that high overall. So that was their plan, was to do that. They were primarily, when we first got in there, when I first got in there, you know, yeah, it was home equity and some IO product and the pay option. The pay option was their main source of growth though in 2006 when I was there. The pay option was the big thing. And admittedly, there were many discussions between myself, my supervisor, Delora G., Doug, who you're going to talk to, the controller, who you'll talk to. There were many discussions regarding pay option mortgages, IO mortgages, you know, the concerns that we had around these. We talked about these in some of our letters. We didn't blatantly ever come out and say, no, you can't do these, but we were all saying, what is this product, especially the pay option that would have the neg am feature on it. Mm-hmm. You know, personally, I would say, I told the controller, when we were talking about the NTM guidance, you know, what do we do around this? I said, I think we say no to neg am. But, I mean, obviously, bigger powers than me, whether it's the, it wasn't just the OCC guidance in the end, as we know, the NTM guidance was the Federal Reserve, the OTS, the FDIC, and the OCC together, came together on that. And they says, okay, we'll allow it, but we'll just basically limit how you, you know, you're going to have to qualify the borrowers to basically repay the thing over a period of time at the highest rate.
Not the teaser.
Not the teaser. And also consider the potential neg am balance as well. So, yeah, we were all talking about it. We would talk to management and the bank about it. Where there were many discussions around these pay option mortgages. And not only just the features of the negative am, but also the features of the stated income. But now, I will say every bank out there was doing stated income lending. It wasn't just a countrywide thing. So it was the risk layering. Yeah, we were very concerned about it.
So are concerns about growth, in the non-traditional payment option arm product, lots of discussions internally and with the bank about that. Understandings that Countrywide, when they do pay option arm, will qualify borrowers at the index rate, consider negative AM.
Well, that was the new NTM guidance when
okay.
it came out, yeah.
Okay.
Which was right before they announced their conversion.
Okay. So were they doing that prior to the guidance?
Were they qualifying them at the full rate? No, they were not.
Did you guys know that?
Yes.
I mean, just so you know, I used to be a bank examiner back in the day.
You did?
Yeah, for the OTS during the S&L crisis back in the 80s and 90s. Lincoln Savings and all that fun stuff. So I know a little bit about it. I mean, that was a prior career. So were there? I mean, I don't know if we've seen this in the supervisor letters or exam reports, but were there concerns about the OCC and you in particular have concerns about, you know, the fact that they weren't qualifying pay option arm borrowers or considering negative AM?
Well, let me back up. So before the NTM guidance came out, we did have home equity. I will talk about this for a second. The home equity guidance that was issued in 2005 said that the bank should consider. So let me make sure you understand. The home equity lines of credit were done at variable interest rates, right? And they were done, like, say you get a $100,000 line of credit. Pretty much every bank was doing these in interest-only product at a variable interest rate. And what the home equity guidance said, and we did write them up for, was the fact that they needed to make sure that they stressed. They made sure that when they did a debt-to-income ratio, they didn't just do them at the current rate of 4%, that they had to stress the interest rate as well as qualify them on an amortizing basis. And we did have, we did write them up for that. And I say write them up, and I'm sure you've seen if you review the reports, matters requiring attention. Those were matters that we expected them to correct. And it was written up in our home equity letter in 2005, again in 2006, and their response to us, in 2006. At that point in time, the NTM guidance had just come out right before their response, in between our letter and their response, and they said, we do plan on correcting this in the, at the same time that we fold this in for our pay option mortgages and the NTM guidance. So they realized it was kind of the same thing, so they were going to do it both.
And again, this HELOC guy, the HELOCs issue you're talking about with the matter requiring attention, immediate attention, that's a result of your summer 2005 targeted review of the HELOC?
I know it was in 2006. In 2005...
You had mentioned before you became EIC when you were working, I guess, with Mr. Hall, you were doing a targeted review of I call them HELOCs.
It was a matter requiring attention in 2006. It was not in 2005. It was listed as a recommendation in 2005. It was before we started. Actually, it wasn't until August 2005 that large banks implemented this matters requiring attention process. So it wasn't a matters requiring attention until 2006 we did that exam.
But it was noted as an issue.
It was noted as a recommendation in 2005.
Was that the supervisory letter, July 21, 2005?
Yes.
So supervisory
and it was noted,
letter.
Let me just read it, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
Expand underwriting criteria to comply with recently issued guidance on borrower's ability to service rate increases on interest only. I think this just talked about rate increases. I think the 2006 said not only rate increases, but amortization.
Okay. Right.
And so you have that letter. It's July 21, 2005, and a supervisory letter 2005-04.
That's the first one.
Okay.
And then the next one is supervisory letter. It's 2006-10, dated November 14, 2006.
And that's the one that says when you're doing HELOCs,
that
don't
says,
not only consider the upward adjusting of the interest rate, but deal with negative AM too.
DTI ratios, right. Says borrower repayment capacity is not adequately assessed. DTI ratios do not consider the impact of principal amortization or an increase in interest rates.
Okay. So that is a year and a half. Between July of 2005 and November of 2006,
still not doing it.
Right. So, I mean, and believe me, I remember this from my OTS days of please do this, we'll come back next year and see if you're doing
it or
not. I mean, is that essentially what it was? I mean, in July of 2005, well, at the end of your exam, you say, look, I've looked at this, you guys need to do this, and then you come back the next year and you find out, or I guess it's sort of a continuous exam thing. But, I mean,
you know, You're right. Let me back up. So again, I'm glad you've been an examiner, so you've been in my shoes a bit. But again, this was examiner. You put out a guidance, right? How much teeth does guidance have in it? And it was one of those things. We put the guidance out, and we kind of gave. I'll admit, we gave not just Countrywide. And again, this wasn't just a Countrywide issue, as far as HELOCs go. This was a pretty much large bank wide issue that they weren't doing this. And we kind of gave them some time to say, okay, we want to push them along, see how far they get. At this point in time, I would say by November 2006, OCC was of the position, you know what, we're not going to just say you got to get them. We'll put MRAs again. And MRAs would be expected to be corrected. And they said in their response that they would correct that. Because at the time, then, the NTM guidance was also out, just had been issued for the pay option mortgage. And so they knew they were going to have to do it. For that. Again, it was just guidance, but I think...
And do you recall, I know the NTM guidance or the pay option ARM guidance comes out in 2006. Do you recall when in 2006?
October 6, 2006.
Okay.
Yeah, it's right here.
Okay. And so when the November 14th, 2006 MRA in terms of the HELOC, what was there, and I know we'll see it in the document,
just to
recall, no, but was there also another MRA saying, and hey, a month ago, the guidance came out on payment option ARM.
No.
Here's another MRA on how you need to deal with that, particularly since in 05 and 06, you guys are doing... What are you doing? You're doing about 25. You're doing over $50 billion of pay option arm in 05 and another 22, 30, close to $40 billion in 06 of payment option arm.
Now, okay, so the guidance was the pay option, the NTM stuff came out in October 06. And again, we separated NTM from HELOC. I mean, we looked at those separate, even though the issues were the same, I agree. But just like we had done with the HELOC guidance that came out in 05, the general, okay, so it was issued in October 06, and we weren't doing an exam right away, but, I mean, the expectation was sit down with your bankers, make sure they're aware of this guidance. They need to get in compliance with this. We knew that they couldn't just flip a switch and be there. But we were like, okay, here's what it says. Here's what you're going to have to do. Now, how are you going to get there, and how long is it going to take you? And those were the discussions we had. In their response then to us for the HELOC guidance, they acknowledged that it was a broad thing, that they were going to address it, you know, for broadly for pay option and home equity all at the same time. And again, at that point, they'd already announced they were converting, and we didn't know how the OTS would view this.
Okay, so, and we'll get to that in a minute. So in 2005, you've walked through this and 06, you've walked through this chronology on the HELOC guidance and mm-hmm. how it related to mm-hmm. the payment option arm. So again, sort of take me through, you know, generally, you also know that, you know, there continues to be significant originations of subprime loans.
Not subprime.
I've got $44 billion in 05, $40 billion in 06.
Not in the bank.
Not in the bank.
Portfolio. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What is it referring to, Chris?
It's my draft memo, so it's all right, I can't it's mark this and give it to you.
No. I was. It looked like a.
We know the payment option arm book went from about four billion, the HFI portfolio, $4 billion in 2004
yes.
to about $28 billion
yeah,
in 05,
I agree.
$32 billion in 06, and that was a huge concentration of not only the loan portfolio, but of equity capital, tier one leverage capital.
Agreed.
At least two times.
Agreed.
So. And we also know that asset quality is rated a 1 throughout this period. So I think what eventually we'll be asking is, to what extent were the concentrations of a high-risk product factored into the rating, to the CAMELS rating,
mm-hmm.
not only to the component rating, but to the composite rating? And were there any discussions internally about these concentrations are too high, given that they allow for the deferral of principal and, in certain cases, interest? So I think that's one of the dynamics that we would like to learn more about.
Okay, is that what we're going to do now?
Sure.
Or we're going to go back to your question.
Let's do that now.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, hindsight 2020, asset quality should not have been rated a 1 there. And I agree, I was calling it a 1. I was in charge, and I'll take full responsibility for that.
Are we talking, let's fix a time. Are you talking about the 2005 ROE?
That's not
right.
Me.
Right. We wouldn't be talking about anything before she
yeah.
was
2006.
With DSC, but we, you know, we're looking at the rating history, and we know that it's 2 rated, and we know that asset quality is 1. But yes, certainly it would be during her tenure there.
The last rating we have, according to this table, is the March 31, 2006. That's I'm sure the as of date.
Yeah. So
you know, it's a 2 across the board, except for asset quality, that's a 1.
What we're calling the 2005 ROE?
2006 ROE is what I think you're talking about.
Based on year-end
2005, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So we're going to call it the 2006
so
ROE.
I would say, you know, we recognize in our report and we recognize in our discussions, you know, in our report to them that credit risk is increasing. That yes, there's concentration, there's increasing layering room risk with stated income loans and pay option mortgages, et cetera. I agree. In hindsight, I would have called it a 2 rated asset quality. It would not have changed the composite rating of that bank from a 2, from, you know, it's a 2. Everything was a 1. I mean, everything was a 2 but asset quality. Asset quality should have been a 2. I'll admit that.
So was that driven by just the delinquencies were low because they had not,
yeah.
they have really not seasoned, and they'd allow for the deferral of principal and in some cases interest.
Right.
So that was.
It was a lot of that was fed by the fact, and we recognize that there is a, it's going to mask the performance of the portfolio when you have high growth and not seasoned.
So, I'm sorry, I was just unclear. So, explain to me the thinking behind the one rating and whether or not there was any internal disagreement.
There was never any internal disagreement on that. There was never any questioning of should it be a one. Well, there was never any questioning above me anyway. I can say maybe at my level we talked about should it be a two, should it be, with my team and I, should it be a two, should it be a one. Like I say, hindsight's, well, hindsight, it might have, should have been worse than that, right? But I should have called it a two. But never did anyone above me question the rating of the one.
And this was as of December
2005. Yes.
Okay, and again, the rating was primarily driven by level of delinquencies, performance, that
losses.
Kind of, right. Okay, and as I think I heard you say, you recognized that, you know, given the nature of these loans, you know, there was negative AM, the term to pick a payment, et cetera, performance was easily going to be good.
Exactly.
Just given the terms of
loan. I would totally agree with you.
Did the OCC look at, Al, tell me if we've seen it, did you guys look at concentrations in terms of the level of the payment option arm book as a percentage of the entire loan portfolio and, more importantly, as a percentage of capital?
Yeah, I mean, we can say, you know, they're concentrated in residential mortgage. I mean, whether you want to call it pay option or home equity or IO arm, I mean, it's all just residential mortgage out there. It is a concentration. They would argue, well, it wasn't a concentration because it's all these little individual borrowers throughout the country. We would say, well, but it's all residential lending. You got all your eggs in one basket. And they said, yeah, but it's all over the country. You know, we said, well, you have a concentration in California of pay option mortgages. We said that.
Did you look at geographic concentrations,
yeah, we looked at
too?
That.
Yeah, that's in one of the supervisory letters issued to the bank.
0605.
Home equity.
Right.
And again, this is, there may not be a lot of things in every letter. I mean, we looked at, like I said, I had a team on site. We were looking at reports regularly. We could see the concentrations in product. We could see the concentrations in geography, in, you know, whatever it be, FICO cuts, LTVs, whatever it may be, we can see all that.
Okay. So, since I don't have it in front of me, and I don't want to say there was a bunch of subprime loans and they were at the parent and not at the bank, what
well,
was
it? I can tell you, there was literally zilch subprime lending done in the bank. We did lower the FICO score from 660 to 620. Originally, when we allowed them in May 2001, when they became a national bank, we said nothing below 660, okay? And 660 is pretty good. We lowered it later to 620, and I don't have the final cut available to me, but I know we could provide you that information because we have that. That it was still, I would say, less than 2 or 3% between 620 and 660 in the bank. So based on FICO score only, let me clarify, based on FICO score only, there was hardly anything below 660. Again, that's not to say there wasn't stuff with high LTV, which is another risk altogether, and stated income, which is another risk altogether.
Right. Okay, so other than the payment option arm book and a very small number of subprime loans at the bank, what were the other, I mean, I know we've seen Alt-A and
And by Alt-A, you mean the state, I don't know what, you know, everybody defines Alt-A a little bit different, so.
Well, I guess I'm defining it however Al defined it when he put together these charts.
Before you leave that, I just
want to make sure that you've registered the fact that there was a target exam on the pay option arm mortgages.
We haven't gotten there yet, yeah.
And, well, we just mentioned the supervisory letter that was issued 2006-05 on September the 5th, 2006. And that's the one that looked at the negative amortization and the concentration in California.
Okay. So tell me about the targeted exam on payment option on the payment option arm book that led to the September 25th, 2006 letter.
Well, in September 2006, we did, or actually that summer, we issued the letter in September 2006. We did a review of the pouch in our portfolio. And this was even before, we didn't, again, we didn't have the NTM guidance out there yet, but we just want to look at this portfolio to see what do we see as the, looked at the models behind it, the underwriting models, the risk, et cetera. And we had some concerns with pay. Really, there was two matters requiring attention we had on that exam. The big one, the overriding, was the fact that we felt like they were not taking, that they were taking a, and this wasn't the words in the letter, but I'll say, I told them at the meeting, I said, you're taking a look at the world through rose-colored glasses. I mean, they were viewing it very optimistically. They had external data, that this was quoted in the letter, they were purchasing external data and had it available to them, MoodysEconomy.com data, UBS data, different things like that, that they would, you know, they would have that data available to them, but still, in their analysis and their and then their scorecard development, they didn't show any depreciation in home price values while everybody else was showing predicted depreciation. I can tell you in discussions, I remember at one of the board meetings, it was probably the 2006 board meeting, and talking about this, and one of the economists that was on the board said, but home prices have never declined overall in the U.S. And I said, well, maybe they haven't, but they have in California, and they had a huge concentration in California. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what he's showing you right there.
He's a summary of your letter that says just what you're saying.
Yeah. So we were critical of their assumptions, basically saying that they needed, that was one of the things, was the home price depreciation. The other one was they constantly were comparing themselves to World Savings and Downey and saying, you know, we do it better than they do because we do this and do that. And we're like, well, really you don't, because of, you know, your FICOs are lower, your teaser rates are lower, you know, whatever it may be. But we were showing them that there were really differences in the two. So I think the big thing out of that is we felt like we don't think you're taking a rigorous enough approach in your assumptions and you need to take a harder look at it. And then two is they need to share that. They need to get an external view. They need to make sure their independent board of directors understood what they were considering so that they were comfortable with the fact of what was being done.
Mm-hmm. So what do they say to you when you point out the fact that you're purchasing data and you have data that predicts a decline in home price appreciation, either a decline in the growth or an actual decline, and yet your models are ignoring that information and assuming rose-colored glasses scenario of,
yeah,
you know, increasing home price appreciation? What is their response?
Well, I mean, when we went over this verbally with them, it was a pretty humbling meeting, I felt. I felt there wasn't a lot of response. There was just a lot of, you know.
And is this a meeting with management and the board?
With management of the bank. Again, this is not holding company. This is generally, I'm talking, when I say managing the bank, Carlos Garcia, Jim Furash, Dave Walker, and Steve Muir, or I mean Mike Muir, Cliff Rossi, you know, generally the people that were managing the bank. And then we issued the letter, and we got a response. And the response that we got to that letter, you know, kind of acknowledged, you're right, we're going to do better on this, and we're going to change our process now going forward. And so we were comfortable with the response on what they were going to do. Going forward, the exam we did in... We did an exam of the allowance in our last exam, I will say. So it was like February of 07 before they converted. I mean, it was the same. Let me back up a minute. Let me go cover one other key exam, I think, before I get to the allowance exam. The credit, I'm done with that. The credit model exam we did in the fall of 06. So that one was like done around, let me find it.
It's a supervisory letter 2006-07.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
2006-07. So we did a review of what we did a follow-up review of some of the things that came out of our home equity exam in the summer of 05, actually, looking at their underwriting and their behavior models again. We had had some concerns with the documentation and the validation around those models. But another key model we looked at was the probability of default model. And again, I'm not going to pretend to be a quant to understand or explain all this, but I'm taking this from a very high level. And we had some concerns with their probability default model. We felt like it was very, they were still in process of developing it, and it was going to feed into their allowance for loan losses, okay? Because if you understand, probability default and then loss on default is what really drives your losses. And so this probability default, and by the way, they were pretty good and as far as loss on default. They knew, particularly on the home equities and stuff, they knew that it was 100% loss on default. I mean, they did that appropriately. So they weren't just tricking themselves into saying, we're going to get part of this back. So that was pretty good, but it was this whole probability default. And we knew that the model was under development. We had serious questions about some of the factors into the that were being put into the model. And we were like, you know, we already had MRAs in the fall of 06 around this model saying, you need to make sure this works right. And we had some continuing things with the other one. So we, and models was driving a lot of their, what they were using to provide for the allowance and how they were predicting what their losses were going to be going for the next 12 months.
And I take it their models were not projecting declines in home price appreciation.
They were not. So that's what we're saying, that was not part of it too. So then when we come in February then of 07, so I'm covering what I think are the three or four key credit exams that we did. We did one in February 07 that was the allowance review, and that was looking at not only this, so now you've got this probability default model in place. Let's look at that, as well as we want to look at all the other methodology surrounding your allowance methodology. And that at that exam, we said, you know, kind of just as we expected, this probability default model, it's not working as intended. They were constantly catching up to what it was under predicting what their probability default was, and so they were having to make an upward adjustment each quarter to what it was going to be. And so we basically said, and they recognized that there were weaknesses in that model. The thing was, they had no history to go on. I mean, this pay option product was a fairly new product. They didn't have anything to model on it other than their best assumptions of what would happen. But again, it's back to this whole making sure the realistic assumptions are in there. So we had two MRAs again in the February 07 exam. One was the PD model was under predicting, and you needed to make sure that you continue revising this model, documenting it, validating, and making sure it worked as it's supposed to. And two was there was other I would call it more governance or methodology type things around the whole process where, you know, once you come up with a specific number out of this model, then you need to kind of look at these other subjective factors such as growth and, you know, changes in underwriting criteria, things like that to kind of factor whether you should increase the allowance for these things or decrease it or whatever it may be. But in other words, they weren't not doing enough of that. So we had these two big MRAs around that.
And that is referenced in the supervisory letter 2007-02, which is dated March the 1st, 2007.
Yeah.
Okay. So, were you finished?
Yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah.
Look.
Oh, I, so what I can I'm talk here, a long time.
And I appreciate it. It helps, especially since, as you can tell, I'm not even close to being up to speed. But so what I'm hearing is, you guys see the growth in the payment option arm book and you recognize the concentrations. And at the same time, you know, you're finding some problems. You know, whether it's a probability of default model not being up to snuff or, frankly, not even being developed yet or in the process of development. The fact that the company, you know, has information projecting home price declines yet doesn't think that's going to happen and is not incorporating that into their models in any event. And, of course, it's the nature of the payment option arm book, you know, being one that home price appreciation does stop. That's probably going to have an impact on a payment option arm book more than it would on the standard 80% loan-to-value ratio owner-occupied 30-year fixed-rate loan. So I'm curious if, given those facts, and I'm sure other facts that I don't know about, if there was ever any consideration within the OCC to tell Countrywide to stop originating this product, or to at least slow down the origination of this product, or to increase capital, or increase loan loss allowances, or any of the usual things you do when you have concerns about concentrations in a particular portfolio and asset quality in general?
We didn't talk about telling this. I mean, again, I know I don't want to beat up on this. I know we all talked about, we were concerned about that. They were getting the NTM guidance out. The NTM guidance came out. In the end, it wouldn't have stopped any bank from doing those type of products, including Countrywide.
I think what she's telling you is that the OCC had concerns, the supervisory staff had concerns, and they were communicating those to the bank and trying to tell the bank what kind of controls they need to put in to better monitor the product and alleviate the risk that was developing.
Sure, and I understand that, and that's why I was asking, was there also, I mean, I don't think it ever happened from the documents, but internally, was there discussions within the OCC saying,
no,
you know, do we need to take the next step? Should we tell these guys to increase their
loan loss?
Probably
if they had stayed in National Bank, we would have gotten there. Mm-hmm. But by them telling us in November of 2006, they were converting. It wasn't like we were just sitting there doing nothing. We continued doing exams and issuing letters. But, you know, we also felt like it was just a matter of days or months, short time before they converted, and the OTS was going to have to, you know, and it was something that they were a different supervisor. In some cases, they were not taking as strong of an approach as we were. Mm-hmm. So we didn't want to say no to pay option lending if they didn't have a problem with that. I mean, there were things that we had already raised concern about that we felt that were not going to be enforced upon them as a threat that, you know, they were going to continue doing.
Did anybody at Countrywide, or did you have any discussions with anybody at Countrywide about why they were switching charters?
Yeah. The official word or the unofficial
Well,
word?
I want both,
okay.
and who the official
who
and unofficial
were?
Words
yeah.
came
yeah.
from.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, there are several letters in your documentation around this appraisal independence thing, and I think that was a key. This is a key driver of their decision, in my opinion. Not the officially, but in my opinion, and I'll tell you why. The chronology on this whole thing, it goes back again to in July of 2005 in our home equity exam. We had a recommendation around appraisal independence ordering, appraisal ordering independence, okay? And I think you know what that means, but what that's basically about is that the loan production side should be totally separated from the appraisal ordering side so that there is no conflict of opinion, that the appraiser is not given any type of value that they need to come up with to, you understand, like if somebody's needing a loan for $500,000, they say, oh, we need a loan to meet this $500,000, so we're trying to separate it. Again, this is a recommendation because we didn't do MRAs at that point in time.
Were they using in-house appraisers?
They used outside appraisers. They had LandSafe Appraisal was a appraisal management company that they had internally, but it used outside appraisals. But the retail side, not the broker, not the correspondent, but their own originations, whatever, they could influence. They could tell them which appraiser to use. Okay, so. This was becoming, so we put that as a recommendation. In the 2005, I'll say the second half of 2005, within the OCC, this was becoming a big concern to us. We issued, we issued a lot of guidance on this, and we were becoming very concerned, not just Countrywide, Wells Fargo, B of A, JP Morgan, all the big players. It was becoming a big concern because we felt it was driving a lot of volume. It was going to get some bad practices out there, and we felt we needed to do something about it. So as an agency, we kind of took a horizontal view of this, who's still not complying with this, and realized that Countrywide wasn't quite in discussions right when I took over into December 2005, January 2006. Discussions, we recognized they still weren't there yet. So you'll see reference in your documentation a February 2006 letter from them to us saying, you know, we recognize the importance of appraisal ordering. We want to try to get there. And they kind of, I won't go through the whole thing, but they kind of go this whole thing of, well, here's our process and here's how we plan to get there, and we'll get there by year end 2006. Okay? Are you trying to give them a
which letter was it?
It's February 14th, 2006, from Countrywide to me.
It's this one.
So then, further discussions between, so they gave us that letter, further discussions internally in OCC, again, around this whole thing about banks were still doing this, et cetera, you know, we needed to put a halt to this. And everybody was like, well, we can't stop it here until we stop it there. You know, Wells Fargo and Countrywide were the two biggest mortgage originators, and we're not going to stop at one place to the other. So 2006-03 letter issued March 30th, 2006, basically said, you know, independence and appraisal ordering, longstanding issue, and OCC expects banks to fix this in a timely manner, and we expected all of them to get corrective action by June 30th, 2006. That's when we said, okay, enough. We're tired of toying around with you. Fix it by this date.
And so was Wells Fargo also
yes.
doing the same thing that
yes.
Countrywide was doing? So
yes.
They got a letter, too?
They got a letter, too.
Okay.
Yeah, so it wasn't just Countrywide. So they came back and responded to us in April 2006, which you have, April 28th, 2006. Again, a long letter of, you know, they're going to have to work through some processes and some systems and all that. And I will say, I think they were trying to fix it. I don't think they were toying with us. And I say, I think the bank was trying to fix it. Angelo Mazzillo, Dave Samble, those people were having discussions with me, and they were like, you're trying to kill our business model.
Well, did you ask him how getting independent appraisals would kill his business model?
Well, we did. I mean, there were many discussions between our a big meeting but with Dave Samble, I can't remember all the other people that were there. Angelo wasn't at this meeting, but there was a big meeting. Jack Shackett, I know, who was their head of their servicing. They were all there, and it was about, you know, really how they were trying to explain to the Fed and to us how their processes work and how it was really okay. And we still felt like there were holes in it, and they couldn't fix all these holes. So, and I'll also mention, and I don't know the date of this, but it was around this time, I would say around April or May, that I was invited. That was the first time I ever met Angelo, and I really only was around him a couple of times. But I was invited to the Federal Reserve was doing a presentation at the Countrywide Financial Corp board meeting, and I was in the holding room with the Fed. I was the only lady there. So when Angelo comes in, he's heard about Kim Scheer and pushing for this appraisal independence, and so he walks in. He said, "You must be Kim Scheer," and I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Walk with me," and you know, and I walked with him, and he was pointing out his cronies on the wall and all that stuff. We get to the board meeting, asked me to sit beside him. He's, you know, small talking about did I know the Jerry Hawk, the old controller, and yeah, I know Jerry, blah, blah, blah. And I said, but have you met Mr. Dugan yet? And he said, no, he says, but I hear he's on an appraisal rampage. So, I mean, that was his comment, only comment about John Dugan. I hear he's on an appraisal rampage. He did meet John, and I'm sure you'll be talking to him. I know you're talking to him later this week, but when we met with him, and it was sometime later that summer, John Dugan, Doug Roeder, myself met with Angelo, and he asked then, what does it take to be a thrift?
And when is that?
I don't know exactly. I want to say it's around the summer of 06.
Okay.
What does it take to be a thrift, or what does it take to convert to a thrift?
I hear you taking me through the chronology of, you know.
Okay, and I'll tell another one. So Jim Furash, who's the president of the bank, mentioned again, I guess sometime later on in summer of 2006, early fall, whatever. He's like, you know, he mentioned at that time, he said, this appraisal thing is really a big deal for us. He said, you know, there are some here that think we'd rather be a thrift than a national bank if this is what it's going to, if this is what it's going to be.
And that's Mr. Furash, you said?
Yeah.
And that ballpark
and that
timing?
Was in confidence. You know, obviously don't.
Ballpark timing, though?
I'm going to say late summer, early fall.
And when he was referring to if this is what it's going to be, he was referring
dependence,
to...
If we're going to keep pushing this dependence ordering.
Independence
appraisal yeah,
ordering
yeah.
process.
So
let me stop you for a, okay. for a minute. Would that simply mean that a different department orders the appraisal?
They had... Yeah, what it basically means is that the appraiser has no idea what the loan amount is. That's what it really amounts to.
Right. Okay.
It's just separate.
We're talking about primarily single-family residences and condominiums, et cetera, where, right, where the appraiser is going to go out and look at sales. I mean, that's, I mean, we've all seen those appraisals. It's not like you're trying to come up with a value of a multi-residential office, a multi-residential building or an office right. building or land, God forbid. But, I mean, those appraisals tend to be, unless there's flipping
vanilla.
Activity going
well,
on.
Well, there
yeah.
was. And there was.
But I mean, that's the... So what I'm trying to understand is, I mean, I get it. I mean, if there's
yeah.
actual concerns about, you know, look, the loan broker or the loan officer saying, you know, I've got an application in here for a $500,000 payment option ARM loan with a nice negative AM feature on it and a 1% teaser, and I need the appraisal to come in at 6, at least, you know, so don't come back until you have an appraisal at 6. But were those concerns that the OCC had, did you guys see that there were those kinds of improprieties taking place?
Yeah, I mean...
So give me an example of seeing those kinds of
improprieties. Well, I mean, we saw appraisals that maybe didn't look quite like they were in line with what they should be. There was some evidence of... And again, this is really primarily through the Federal Reserve, so I can't remember all the details of this, but there was evidence of maybe a whistleblower thinking that there was, like, action going on where appraisers were being coerced to up their values on their appraisals there by certain officers at Countrywide.
Did you see that yourself or hear
the
about
bank,
it from the Fed? Or?
I heard about it from the Fed.
But again, I mean, I'm just thinking of, you know, you look at the backside of the appraisal and you see the subject property and then the columns for the
right.
comps, right? And again, putting aside the issue of flipping going on, I mean, if the prices are there and the properties are comparable, it's sort of hard to game the appraisal. And I remember back in the day when I looked at appraisals, one of the things you'd look at on the sales approach is if the adjustments were more than 10%, right? Because that would sort of tell you that, well, maybe it's not a comparable property. I mean, were those the kinds of things you guys were seeing where it was either one, you know, look, when I see three comparable sales and we're making 30% price adjustments to get
you
to
know,
the subject.
I can't say we were seeing a lot of that stuff. But again, I'll just say it's the principle of the whole matter is that we just felt like it needed to be separated.
Okay. And they were clearly pushing against it and making
yes.
statements like if push comes to shove, we may switch charters.
Yes.
Okay, now.
Now, and then there was one other thing that also kind of never really, again, before I get to the official conversion, that they, there was, at, we were growing our staff, and you could tell there was, you know, say by the auditing side, by the compliance side, different ones, you know, so we were asking for more space, we were beefing up our team, we were in their face more. I mean, we were doing more exams, we were having more meetings, we were doing a lot more. So I think no one really, there, I can't even remember the exact words, but you just sense that there was a kind of a feeling of, whoa, you know, you're going from a staff of 1 to 8 and doing more work and, you know, that was kind of like.
Asking for more information,
yeah,
asking
more
for more management time.
Yeah.
We getting more letters,
yeah, right.
telling us to
more
do
MRAs,
stuff.
More MRAs, you got to fix this, you got to fix it, yeah. So there's a bit of that.
I mean, did they tell you guys that they felt that the burden, you know, was
exactly.
was going up?
And I say, if I said yes, you'd say, who said it? And I can't remember who said it, so I don't know.
Okay. But
so
yes,
I,
you heard
I,
it,
I
you just don't recall from who.
Yeah. I just sensed that it was a sense of more regulatory burden and cost. So when, I guess it was November the 7th, 2006, I received a call from either Carlos Garcia's or Jim's, Urash's secretary, you know, somebody up there saying they wanted to meet with me that afternoon. Didn't tell me what it was about, but mentioned to me that that I guess Angelo had a call in to talk to the controller, and they wanted to talk to me after that. So I knew there was something big. I knew it was something big, and I had a sense that that's what it was. I wasn't sure, but I had a definite sense that's what it was.
You see that's what it was, that they were
the
going to switch charters.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And so, so sure enough, you know, so I had sent an email to Doug, you know, and you may have seen that email saying, you know, I'm not sure what's going on. I feel like, you know, something big is going on. And he says, we'll keep you posted, et cetera. So as soon as, I mean, maybe, and I'm going to guess on the times, I don't think, I was going to say it was around 1 o'clock or so in the afternoon.
So you sent an email to Doug.
Doug Roeder.
Thank you.
who you're interviewing later, right. And you don't have the email yet. It's coming in our next production.
Okay. But basically, it just said, you know, I don't know what's going on, but something's going to be, you know, something's coming up. And he said, okay, you know, stay tuned. And that was really all. That's all the email said. You'll see it.
Okay.
So anyway, I did have a meeting. Whatever, I want to say it was early afternoon, late morning, early afternoon, you know, I went up and met with them, and sure enough, it was those two, Carlos Garcia, Jim Furash, and the official word, and I mean, they were very forthcoming. They just said, you know, our board and management of Countrywide has decided to apply for a thrift charter, basically because, you know, they felt that the OTS, you know, they strictly managed mortgage companies, and that's really what they dealt with, was residential lending and things like that, and felt that they would understand their business model more than OCC did, and that also it would do away with two regulators down to one. You know, it wouldn't be just OTS. I mean, it wouldn't be OCC and Federal Reserve, it'd just be OTS. So that was, again, the burden thing. You know, it made sense, mm-hmm. Totally. I got the sense the decision, again, was being driven a lot by the parent, not by the bank. I felt, you know, Carlos and Jim always seemed to appreciate OCC's input. Again, it may just be my view, but I thought that they appreciated that we added value a lot and gave them good feedback and good recommendations. But I think management of the holding company truly didn't like the Fed and the OCC in their face all the time.
Did any internal discussions, whether here at the OCC or with folks at Countrywide, about flipping charters because OTS is an easier regulator, other than the context of this appraisal ordering independence issue?
Other than that, certainly not with anyone at the bank. Yeah, the OTS kind of had that view, but you know, that may just mean me and my team. Nothing certainly.
When you said the OTS had that view.
I mean, OCC had that view. The OTS was an easier regulator. But no one above me. No one ever said. You know, actually, I will say that we breathed a sigh of relief when they said they were converting. Everybody has said, good on you, Kim.
And why did you breathe a sigh of relief?
Well, because we felt like, you know, we could see this was just like bubbling up to be a big problem. The problems were just forthcoming.
Now, we know they actually apply in December of 06, and the OTS approves it on March 12, 2007. Do you have any discussions with the OTS folk?
I had a couple of meetings with Lawrence Carter, Daryl Dokow.
Doko, I think it is.
Finn,
I believe.
Yeah.
Was the regional director
Mike Finn and Daryl? Mike Finn and Daryl met with me once, I know, and just to kind of give them a brief, you know, our view of kind of the bank and the risk and all that stuff. And I mean, I was very open with them. Whatever it was, I mean, we all laid it out there. Lawrence Carter talked to him a bit. He wanted to get more of the details about how do we supervise and, you know, what. You know, I explained this whole thing about our supervisory letters and our targets and our ongoing reviews, and just kind of explaining that because they were going to try to mirror that some. I'm not, you know, again, I'm not sure what they ended up doing as far as what size of staff, if they were on site or what in the end they did.
Maybe now would be a good time to refer to your March 12, 2007 letter to the bank. It's a supervisory letter 2007-04, which is CC to Lawrence Carter at the OTS.
Before we get there, but yes, I do want to get, no, that's fine, and I appreciate that, and please don't stop. I do appreciate that. Did you ever tell Doco Carter or Finn or anybody else at the OTS that the OCC was breathing a sigh of relief because you thought things were bubbling up to become a big problem at countrywide?
No. And maybe I should have said that while ago. Maybe that was Kim that breathed a sigh of relief. I don't know.
Did you have any discussions with them about this whole appraisal ordering independence issue? I mean, I know that they got the documents and probably saw it in there, but did you have any discussions with them and tell them at least your sense that that could have something to do with why they were flipping charters?
I don't recall. I really don't. Honestly, I don't.
Okay.
Again, they have all the letters, but I can't remember if we specifically talked about that one issue as being a...
So what were the things that come to mind were the main things that you talked about with the OTS?
Well, I'll refer to this letter now, this 2007-04 letter, which is the closeout letter that kind of lists that, you know, here are the outstanding matters requiring attention, and I think there were five at that time, which we discussed all of them.
Here's the letter.
So this is the March 12, 2007 letter that you're talking about, and it has five MRAs.
Yeah. And we've discussed each of those, I think, you know. Well, I think we have, but...
Do you want to see the one?
Sure.
We've got the letter
for
Do you want to see the letter to talk about? It has the five MRAs.
We don't have it.
Well, that's not it right there?
Oh, sorry. 2007-04.
You don't have it?
No. Thank you.
And as I'm reading this, explain to me, I've seen in letters going to the OCC, matters requiring immediate attention, as opposed to matters requiring attention.
Don't have that. That's the Federal Reserve's term.
You know what? You're right. I'm sorry. Yeah. That was a Federal Reserve letter I'm thinking of.
Could we mark this as number one?
Sure. Do you want any particular convention or just upper right-hand corner?
Document number one.
Based on what I know about that, though, I think the Federal Reserve's matters requiring immediate attention are like our matters requiring attention.
Okay.
That's based on what I...
Important, get on it now.
Yeah. We expect you to fix this.
Oh, I see it. I should have just kept reading it. It gives me the definition. Ah, okay. Very first one. And you've talked about the creditors' model development and evaluation. You've talked about the debt-to-income ratio.
Yeah, that fourth one we may not have mentioned, but that was around the automated valuation, the ABM validation. They still needed to improve some of that stuff on the...
Okay, and is the automated valuation model a...
collateral tool.
Is it for loss allowances, or is
no,
it for appraisal purposes? Or?
It's really more, they use it in underwriting. They would say, okay, what's this house, if it's a small enough loan, they use it primarily in the home equity world. Is they say, okay, it's not just them, it's, again, every bank, but it was like, okay, how much is this house worth? And you run a little, it's kind of like, what is it, Zillow.com?
Right.
How much is my house worth?
Right.
And we're saying they need to validate those models and get it more down to the granular level.
It's a depressing site to go to the last couple of years.
Tell me. Especially when you buy a house in San Francisco in 2007.
San Francisco maintained value a lot if you bought in the city.
I bought the East Bay. So.
Oh, well, I'm in Walnut Creek, so I know.
I'm in Danville.
I know how it is.
So I just want to refer you in the letter, document number one, the fact that it was CC'd to Lawrence Carter at the OTS. And also, on the last page, the notation that the OCC's expectations are that the bank and the Office of Thrift Supervision can use this list to work together to make sure all outstanding supervisory matters are resolved.
Mm-hmm.
So, as of this time, there are five
outstanding issue, MRIs, yeah.
Okay.
And to close out of the exam, the ratings are still twos across the board with the exception of one for Issaquah.
You know, we, yes.
Because that's what DOTS, yes. DOTS adopts, yes. Your rating.
Yes.
And then they start their own supervisory program.
Yes. We did not issue another report of exam with ratings, so it's the last one, but not the last one. Yeah.
So the ratings were still based on December?
We did not, yes.
Can I ask you a question? When Lawrence Carter was asking you about how the OCC goes about its supervision of Countrywide, mm-hmm. did you get the sense that they had a program off on the shelf to effectively supervise $100 billion?
Well, they had one move, right? Similar size. If
I guess it was three times larger, you would think.
What's WAMU?
I think WAMU was
$300 billion
plus.
Yeah. So, yeah, so you, and he had come from WAMU. But I got the impression, though, that they didn't have as much exam staff on site full time like we did. I don't know, but he was wanting to know what we did and how we did it. Now, again, I explained all that, and I think they were going to, maybe he was going to be on site half the time, kind of thing. But not full time. He would have to talk about, did they do something different than that? I don't really know.
Have you taken a look by any chance at the complaint the SEC filed against Countrywide and the various emails that are in that complaint and that have been talked about in some of the congressional hearings? And I didn't bring any with me, but there's emails going back as early as like April of 2005, you know, internal emails where folks within the company are saying, we recognize default rates on these kind of loans are going to be twice as much as conventional type loans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Those are emails in internal emails.
Internal Countrywide emails. And on
so
getting
I haven't
it,
seen
did
those.
You have, well, and I didn't think so. But I'm wondering if you had conversations with anybody within Countrywide. Were they acknowledged or at least discussed with you? Yeah, you know, when we're doing FICO 660 or 620, even though it's a small amount in the bank, and when we're doing all day, whatever that may be, and when we're doing payment option arm, yeah, you know, we recognize that these things are riskier and the default rates are going to be a lot higher. Any kind of conversations like that with folks at Countrywide?
Well, I mean, yeah, and that they were predicting higher default rates on some of these products than what their historical products have been. The question was, we didn't think, obviously, some of these, their assumptions were still not tough enough when we got into look at the models. But I didn't see those emails.
Did you ever share any information? Or did the Federal Reserve ever share any information with you about the independence of the credit review function? And the reason I ask is because in your production we saw this document, and we'll show it to you. And on the second page, the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco sent the holding company a concern that there was a lack of independence in the credit review function. It's on the second page. And it's highlighted.
Yeah.
And so since most of the lending for the investment portfolio, most of the lending was for the investment portfolio and it occurred out of the bank, we were wondering if they had shared that information with you or if the OCC had any similar conclusions about the independence of the credit review function.
Well,
And what that is that's just a target exam of market, credit, and operation risk. And then they looked exclusively into the enterprise-wide risk management,
right?
And that's when I saw that you don't have any independent loan review function, you know.
Well, okay. Two things. One is this is prior to me, but
right.
But two is, you know what? Maybe they didn't have an independent credit review function in the holding company, but they did in the bank. And what the bank would do is. So when things originated in the holding company, Countrywide Home Loans was the mortgage engine there, then it was all automated, et cetera, and certain triggers would trigger, if it met the bank's product profile and underwriting criteria, it would flip over to the bank, it would go through their automated engine, and then they would only accept things that met theirs, and then they would have their own independent QC functions, I should say, quality control functions. So we reviewed that.
Okay. Can we have Martha's as document number two?
Sure.
Just for the record, can you give the base numbers?
It's OCC 16-00301587. Do you want to put document number two?
Through 9-2.
Did you get that?
Did you folks ever, I mean, we've heard since now there's been lawsuits and other documentation about fraudulently originated loans at Countrywide. Did you guys find any issues with that while you were looking at, the sample of new loans originated, et cetera?
No.
Some questions I should have asked in the beginning. Explain to me the reporting structure. Who do you report to? When you're EIC at Countrywide.
Okay. When I was EIC at Countrywide, I reported to Delora G, J-E-E, Delora N-G, her middle name, capital N-G.
And I'm sorry, I have to spell the last name again.
J-E-E. She was the large bank deputy comptroller. And Delora reports to Doug Roeder, who's a senior deputy comptroller, who reports to John Dugan.
Okay. And you're the EIC from?
The time?
Sounds like 05.
December 05. I mean,
right. The summer 05, target exam, not as EIC, and then you take over at the end of 05, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Who were the exam
members?
Were there a lot of, I don't want to give you a memory quiz here, but to the extent it was sort of the same number.
The credit exam? Just the credit exam.
Right. Which exam are you talking
about? I'm talking about all of them. But by your question, I'm now assuming that there are different members of different targeted exam teams.
Well, I can. Okay, so again, I had a team of 7 people working for me that came on during a span of time over 2006.
Okay.
Now, do you want to know? You want to know all the names, or just the ones who are really involved in the credit exams?
Let's go with all of them, but start with the ones that are the most important that are involved in the area you care about.
And then if you want to, I can give you some of the names. I can't recall all of them that might have facilitated on the credit exams.
Sure.
If that would help.
Sure.
Okay, so on the credit side, so the key players are Alex Williams, Charlene Hamlet, H-A-M-L-E-T-T. And non-credit, there's another one, Manuel, M-A-N-U-E-L, Rosette, R-O-S-S-E-T-T. Other examiners there include, I just thought of another one, Molly Scherf, M-O-L-L-Y-S-C-H-E-R-F, Harvey Wright, W-R-I-G-H-T, Debbie Fussell, F-U-S-S-E-L-L, Stan Sorensen, S-O-R-E-N-S-E-N, and I have one more than I thought when I said 8.
That's 7,
but there's one more, Howard Ratner, R-A-T-N-E-R.
And all of these folks are involved in the credit exam?
No,
the first two?
Charlene and Alex were the primary ones. Alex in charge of the first mortgage stuff, Charlene for the home equity. Molly Scherf also did the reverse mortgage stuff, but we didn't do very much in that. And Manuel Rosette was the allowance he did the allowance exam. The others were either compliance or information technology or governance, that type of stuff, affiliates.
Okay, and then within, I understand that you report to G, who reports to Roeder, who reports to Dugan, but are there other people, non-examiner type folk, that are assigned to Countrywide?
From the OCC?
Yes, of course. No, from anywhere.
Maybe a licensing person, okay. Or
there's not like a financial analysis division in the OCC.
No,
way back in the day at the OTS.
Yeah, we kind of had that too. Yeah, no, we don't. We don't have that.
Okay. Well, there were support people.
Well, I mean,
back
like licensing and legal people to, that support as we needed them, kind of
right.
thing.
But
I don't think
day to day.
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, maybe the lowest analyst. Okay. Other than Doko, Carter, and
Finn.
What's the other name? And Finn. Anybody else that you spoke to at the OTS
no.
in terms of the charter flip?
No.
Any dealings with Countrywide by you after March 12, 2007?
No. Many of their management team now works at Union Bank. Not many, a few. Tim Winnes, who was the chief operating officer of the bank, later became president of the bank after I left, is now.
Did the OCC ever make any criminal referrals related to Countrywide?
No.
Follow up another time. Okay, so let me ask you what I ask everybody towards the end, and that is, you know, now that you've had a chance to live through it and breathe a sigh of relief, when you look back, you know, what lessons learned, mistakes made, etc., when you look back at the OCC's regulations, if any, you know, what things do you think the OCC may have missed? What things do you think the OCC could have done better? Or do you think you guys did what you were supposed to do?
You know, I think we did a good job with our supervision of this company. Like I mentioned, probably hindsight, probably would have called it a two asset quality, but that's not I don't consider that a big miss. You know, that's a difference in a two and a one is not a big deal. I think the OCC and many regulators would say we should have tried to wrap ourselves around this stated income lending probably quicker than we did. Got some more guidance around that, which I think we're trying to do now. So I think that's one lesson learned from all of us, and it's not just related to Countrywide. Other than that, I'm pretty proud of the job we did there.
Okay, and just so I'm understanding, is the stated income, is that
low doc lending?
No, I know what that is. I mean, is that broader than the payment option arm portfolio?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Home equity, payment option, first mortgage, interest only.
That was a risk layer that spanned.
Yeah.
Okay. Al, do you have anything? Claire?
Anything? She recalled the name of the whistleblower you referenced.
The
earlier.
What?
The whistleblower you referenced earlier.
No, I don't.
Well, Kim, thank you very much for your time. I'll tell you what I tell everybody else when we get done with an interview, and that is we'll look at our notes, talk amongst ourselves, probably figure out we forgot to ask you something, and if so, we'll, of course, call Linda, and if necessary, do a quick follow-up by phone so
okay.
we don't have to haul
no,
you out
good.
Here or anything.
Also, could we I know that Alyssa gave you a couple of extra documents. Can we just identify what they are and mark them?
Sure.
P07.
So, for the record, let's make sure this is abundantly clear. We've marked two documents so far. Document number one was the March 12, 2007 supervisory letter 2007-4. Document number two was the September 8, 2005 letter from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco to Mr. Mazzillo that we actually brought and showed you guys. So why don't we mark now as number three the October 3rd, 2006 OCC supervisory letter 2006-7, And as number four, let's mark the March 1, 2007 OCC Supervisory Letter 2007-2.
That's on the allowance?
On the allowance for loan and lease loss examination, yes.
And there was a February 14th letter that we talked about, what Kim did. That's for coming to the next production.
Okay, great. Was there anything?
Well, what about the 2007-4, the closeout letter? Did you have
that one? That was document number one.
Okay.
The one where you copied OTS.
So thank you all very much for your
time.
Very much appreciate it.
Thank you.